in order to come alive while playing it. The game has to be real. You have to mean it. The game is a measure of you. How you act in the game establishes how you will be regarded by the other players. The rules of the game. As in any game, the people game has rules that must be honored if you're to become any good at it. I've included a few here to give you a taste for them. As for the rest of them, you'll have to discover them for yourself by playing a game of your own. You'll learn the rules in the process. The first rule. Never figure out what you want your people to do and then try to create a game out of it. If it's to be seen as serious, the game has got to come first. What your people do, second. Two, never create a game for your people that you're unwilling to play yourself. They'll find you out and never let you forget it. Three, make sure there are specific ways of winning the game without ending it. The game can never end because the end will take the life right out of your business. But unless there are victories in the process, your people will grow weary. Hence, the value of victories now and then. They keep people in the game and make the game appealing, even when it's not. Number four, change the game from time to time. The tactics, not the strategy. The strategy is your game's ethic, the moral underpinning of your game's logic. This must remain sacrosanct, for it is the foundation of you and your people's commitment to each other. But change is necessary. For any game can become ordinary, no matter how exhilarating it may be at the beginning. To know when change is called for, watch your people. Their results will tell you when the game's all but over. The trick is to anticipate the end before anyone else does, and to change it by executive action. You'll know if you've pulled it off by watching how everyone responds to the change. Not at first, however. You can expect some resistance at first, but persist. Your persistence will move them through their resistance into your new and more enlivening game. Rule number five. Never expect the game to be self-sustaining. People need to be reminded of it constantly. At least once a week, create a special meeting about the game. At least once a day, make some kind of issue about an exception to the way the game has been played and make certain that everyone knows about it. Remember, in and of itself, the game doesn't exist. It is alive to the degree that people make it so. But people have the unerring ability to forget everything they start and to be distracted by trivia. Most great games are lost that way. To make certain yours isn't, don't expect your people to be something they're not. Remind them, time after time, of the game they're playing with you. You can't remind them too often. Six, the game has to make sense. An illogical game will abort before it ever gets going. The best games are built on universally verifiable truths. Everyone should be able to see them if they're to be sufficiently attractive. A game with muddy beginnings will get you nowhere. Know the ground you stand on and then assemble your armament. Sooner or later, you'll need it. For a game that isn't tested isn't a game at all. But remember, you can have the best reasons in the world for your game and still end up with a loser if the logic is not supported by a strong emotional commitment. All the logic does is give your people the rational armament to support their emotional commitment. If their commitment wanes, it means that they, and most likely you, have forgotten the logic. So wheel out the logic often. Make sure everyone remembers the game's reason for being. Rule number 7. The game needs to be fun from time to time. Note that I said from time to time. No game needs to be fun all the time. In fact, a game is often no fun at all. That's part of the thrill of playing a game well. Learning how to deal with the no fun part so as to retain your dignity while falling on your face. At the same time, fun needs to be planned into your game. But make certain that the fun you plan is fun. Fun needs to be defined by your people. If it's fun to them, it will work. But not too often, maybe once every 6 months. Something to look forward to and something to forget. And finally, rule number 8. If you can't think of a good game, steal one. Anyone's ideas are as good as your own. But once you steal somebody else's game, learn it by heart. There's nothing worse than pretending to play a game. The logic of the game. To the hotel manager, the boss's game was a good one. So he learned how to play it. It was a simple game, but effective. It was built on the following logic. Most people today are not getting what they want. Not from their jobs, not from their families, not from their religion, not from their government, and most important, not from themselves. Something is missing in most of our lives. Part of what's missing is purpose, values, worthwhile standards against which our lives can be measured. Part of what's missing is a game worth playing. What's also missing is a sense of relationship. People suffer in isolation from one another. In a world without purpose, without meaningful values, what have we to share but our emptiness, the needy fragments of our superficial selves? As a result, most of us scramble about hungrily seeking distraction in music, in television, in people, in drugs. And most of all, we seek things. Things to wear and things to do. Things to fill the emptiness. Things to shore up our eroding sense of self. Things to which we can attach meaning, significance, life. We fast become a world of things. And most people are being buried in the profusion. What most people need, then, is a place of community that has purpose, order, and meaning. A place in which being human is a prerequisite, but acting human is essential. A place where the generally disorganized thinking that pervades our culture becomes organized and clearly focused on a specific, worthwhile result. A place where discipline and will become prized for what they are, the backbone of enterprise and action, of being what you are intentionally instead of accidentally, a place that replaces the home most of us have lost. That's what a business can do. It can create a game worth playing. It can become that place of community. It can become that place where words such as integrity, intention, commitment, vision, and excellence can be used as action steps in the process of producing a worthwhile result. What kind of result? Giving your customer a sense that your business is a special place, created by special people, doing what they do in the best possible way, and all being done for the simplest, most human reason possible, because they're alive. What other reason do you need? Human beings are capable of performing extraordinary acts, capable of going to the moon, capable of creating the computer, capable of building a bomb that can destroy us all. The least we should be able to do is run a small business that works. For if we can't do that, then what's the value of our grand ideas? What purpose do they serve but to alienate us from ourselves, from each other, from who we are? Playing the game. Thinking the way the hotel owner did, you can begin to construct a mental map of the game he created. His hotel became a world in which the sensory experiences of his customer were greeted by a profound dedication to cleanliness, beauty, and order. But this dedication didn't rest on a purely commercial justification, though there was that too. No business could be successful without it. But a moral one. On the boss's philosophy, his view of the world, his idea. The idea was then communicated to his people, both in word and deed, through a well-planned process. The importance of this cannot be overstated. The boss communicated his idea through documented systems and through his warm, moving, and positive manner. He knew that he could communicate the orderly yet human process of pleasing customers to his people only if it were communicated to them in an orderly and human way. In short, the medium of communication became as important as the idea it was designed to communicate. And the hotel's hiring process became the first and most essential medium for communicating the boss's idea. As the manager explained it to me, the hiring process was comprised of several distinct components. 1. A scripted presentation communicating the boss's idea in a group meeting to all of the applicants at the same time. This presentation described not only the idea, but also the business's history and experience in successfully implementing that idea, and the attributes required of the successful candidate for the position in question. 2. Meeting with each applicant individually to discuss his reactions to and feelings about the idea, as well as his background and experience. At this meeting, each applicant was also asked why he felt he was superbly appropriate for the role the position was to play in implementing the boss's idea. 3. Notification of the successful candidate by telephone. Again, a scripted presentation. 4. Notification of the unsuccessful applicants, thanking each for his interest. A standard letter signed by the interviewer. And 5. First day of training to include the following activities for both the boss and the new employee. 1. Reviewing the boss's idea. 2. Summarizing the system through which the entire business brings that idea to reality. 3. Taking the new employee on a tour of the facilities, highlighting people at work and systems at work to demonstrate the interdependence of the systems on people and the people on systems. 4. Answering clearly and fully all of the employee's questions. 5. Issuing the employee his uniform and his operations manual. 6. Reviewing the operations manual, including the strategic objective, the organizational strategy, and the position contract of the employee's position. And 7. Completing the employment papers. And the hiring process is just the beginning. Just think, all of this simply to start a relationship. Are you beginning to understand that systematizing your business need not be a dehumanizing experience, but quite the opposite? That in order to get your people to do what you want, you'll first have to create an environment that will make it possible? That hiring people, developing people, and keeping people requires a strategy built on an understanding of people completely foreign to most businesses? That the system is indeed the solution? That without an idea worth pursuing, there can be no people strategy at all? But with that idea, you can finally say, just as our young manager said, that's where we really shine. Management, people, systems. As I watched Sarah take all this in, I saw that the idea of this integrated view of business had begun to take hold of her imagination. Gone was the resistance, the doubt, and the fear that what I had brought to her door was beyond her, something unreachable for the baker of pies she had come to believe she was. What she was beginning to grasp is that she was a worthy opponent, more worthy than she had ever realized, and that the game I was describing for her was the same game she'd been taught to play by her aunt years ago in her mother's kitchen with such loving attention, that there was absolutely no difference. She smiled at me as though reading my thoughts. She went on to say, "I'm beginning to see the connection between all these things we've talked about. They're all beginning to make sense. The puzzle is coming together. I can see the pieces merge into an exciting picture that I now know has been there all along. All that needed to be done for the picture to take form was for someone to move the pieces into their proper place. I'd like to describe it for you, the picture I'm beginning to see, before I ask you some more questions." "Go right ahead," I smiled. "In fact, I'd be disappointed if you didn't." Sarah continued, "It all goes back to my childhood, of course. To the spirit I spoke about earlier. To what I felt like as a little girl. And I know now that I'm not alone. That I'm not the only one who's ever felt that way. That there were probably lots of other little girls and boys who were suffering the same sort of experience that I was. And lots of grown men and women who, like me, are still carrying around the impact of their early childhood experiences. And so I see my experiences, the corralling of the wild horse, the stuffing away of the spirit my teachers and my parents trained me to do so well, as the beginning of a philosophy for my business, a philosophy that my business needs if I'm ever going to offer anything of true value to my employees and my customers. There'll be no stuffing of the spirit here, my business will say. Maybe I should put it up above the door to remind everyone who comes in what our purpose is." She grinned. "Or maybe, better yet, let thy spirit run free." "Yes, that's better. It even feels better." She laughed aloud with the joy of it. As she continued, it became so clear to me what a miraculous gift speaking can be. I saw that Sarah wasn't so much talking to me, but to herself. Discovering as she spoke the miracles that lived within her experience, within her relationship with her aunt, within her extraordinary imagination, discovering truths she never knew she knew, discovering all the wealth that was waiting there inside of her to be unearthed, to be explored, to be treasured as the words came tumbling forth. As though the words, once freed by the speaking of them, combined with the air to become something else again, a vision, understanding, expansion. Sarah continued, "My picture of the business also goes back to what my aunt taught me about caring. If my aunt were alive today, she would say, if everyone cares, the pies will take care of themselves. And so I can see my business as a school about caring, that teaches all the little things to my employees that my aunt tried so hard to teach me. What it means to pay attention. What it means to our spirits, to be present with the whole of ourselves in everything we do. My God, I thought I hadn't learned anything," she said to me, her eyes wide with the astonishment of what she had just understood. "But I had. I had. And now I'm going to take her place. That lovely woman, that sweet, gentle, determined old woman. I'm going to take her place. I'm going to become the master in my own kitchen, just as she was the master in hers. and the rules of the game. What a joy it's going to be to create them. Rules about dress, rules about comportment, rules about the tools we use and how we use them. Rules about the floor and the walls and the counter space, how we clean them every night and every morning, how we give them their final touch so that they absolutely glow. Rules about the pie tins and about the cupboards in which we store things. Rules about glass. Rules about silver. Rules about tin. Rules about the ovens, how they're heated, how they're opened and closed, how they're cleaned. Rules about opening up and closing up. Rules about money, about keeping the books, about balancing at the end of each day. Rules about hair, about fingernails. Sarah's eyes were flashing as she poured out the beginning of her vision, as her vision began to take shape. She didn't need to know what the specific rules were yet. What was important, that she get a taste of the exercise. As her aunt said, the pies will take care of themselves. Sarah was on her way. "Talk to me more about management," Sarah said. "I heard you say earlier that I don't need professional managers to be successful in my business, that in fact I'm better off without them. What's wrong with hiring experienced managers?"
"Everything's wrong with it, Sarah.
Because if you don't know how to manage, how are you going to choose them, and how are you going to manage them? You can't. Because they will manage by the standards they've been taught to manage by in somebody else's business, not by your standards. Remember delegation rather than abdication? You can't delegate your accountability, Sarah. Delegating your accountabilities is abdication. You, as the shareholder, as the owner, as the COO, as the VP marketing, as the VP finance, whatever positions you take must take full accountability for what's going on in your business. And to do so, you must lead the company in the direction you intended to go. And that means you must set the standard. And one of the most important set of standards you must establish is a management system through which all managers and all those who would become managers in your company are expected to produce results. Standards surrounding your primary aim, your company's strategic objective, the rules of the game. The story you've been telling me about your aunt and about her extraordinary kitchen. And the standards that define the vision you hold in your heart and in your head for the business called All About Pies that you intend to realize. You don't need professional managers to manage to those standards. All you need are people who wish to learn how to manage to them. People who are as personally committed to those standards as you are. In short, you need people who want to play your game, Sarah, not people who believe they have a better one. So you need to invent the rules of the game, which become the foundation of your management system. And once having created these rules, once having created this game, you need to invent the way to manage it. Because your managers don't simply manage people. Your managers manage the system by which your business, All About Pies, achieves its objectives. The system produces the results. Your people manage the system. And there is a hierarchy of systems in your business. This hierarchy is composed of four distinct components. The first is how we do it here. The second is how we recruit, hire, and train people to do it here. The third is how we manage it here. And the fourth is how we change it here. And the "it" I'm referring to is the stated purpose of your business. At Federal Express, it's when you absolutely, positively have to get it there overnight. The "it" of your business, Sarah, is caring. How do you express caring when you answer the telephone? How do you express caring when you take a pie out of the oven? How do you express caring when you take the money from a customer?
and so forth and so on in everything you do at All About Pies. And your answer to those questions is how you do it here. It is the sum total of everything you've created, every distinct process for performing every little task at All About Pies, every bit of which is documented in your operations manuals, every bit of which is taught at your school, every bit of which is managed to and improved upon and discussed among you and your people for as long as you're in business. That's what it is. It is your best way. It is what you believe in. It is why people buy from you, work for you, lend to you, trust you. And just as in the hotel we visited, it is the system, not only the people, that will differentiate your business from everyone else's. Imagine trying to produce such a consistent result without such a system. Imagine each manager in each of your future four stores doing his or her own thing. How would anything be communicated consistently in such a business in which every form of language, every idea of organization, every kind of process and system were expressed in an individual and subjective way by each and every one of your people without any standards, without any agreement, without any consistency in form, in fact, without any consistency in judgment? Is that an appealing picture, I asked? I'm exhausted just thinking about it, Sarah responded. I know, and it's even worse than you can possibly imagine, Sarah. But a management system is something else again. And when it is combined with a well-conceived marketing system... Chapter 17, Your Marketing Strategy. What we have here is a failure to communicate. Anonymous. Your marketing strategy starts, ends, lives, and dies with your customer. So in the development of your marketing strategy, it is absolutely imperative that you forget about your dreams, forget about your visions, forget about your interests, forget about what you want, forget about everything but your customer. When it comes to marketing, what you want is unimportant. It's what your customer wants that matters. And what your customer wants is probably significantly different from what you think he wants. The irrational decision maker. Try to visualize your customer. He's standing before you. He's not frowning, nor is he smiling. He's perfectly neutral. Yet there's something strange about him. Coming out of his forehead, reaching up toward the ceiling, is an antenna. And at the end of the antenna is a sensor beeping away like crazy. And the sensor is taking in all of the sensory data around it, the colors, shapes, sounds, and smells of your store or your office or the restaurant where you're meeting for lunch. The sensor is also taking in sensory data from you. How you're standing or sitting, the color of your hair, how your hair is combed, the expression on your face. Is it tense? Are you looking directly at him or off to the side? The crease in your slacks, the color of your shoes. Are they shined? Are they worn? Are the laces tied? Nothing escapes the sensor as it absorbs the stimuli from the environment. Nothing escapes your customer as he absorbs the information he uses to make his decision to buy or not to buy. But this step in the buying process is only the first. It's what the sensor does with the information that's of interest here. because it's how the sensor processes the information that will determine the decision your customer is about to make. Think of the sensor as your customer's conscious mind. Its job is to gather the information needed for a decision. Most of what it does, however, is unconscious. That is, automatic, habitual. So even though your customer's conscious mind is actively absorbing all manner and forms of impressions, it is totally unaware of most of them. It can do it, literally, in its sleep. In fact, it can't stop doing it. Fortunately, the conscious mind doesn't need to be aware. For it's not your customer's conscious mind that has to make the decisions. It's your customer's unconscious mind. It's in your customer's unconscious mind where all the action is. It's in your customer's unconscious mind where the second step of the buying process takes place. What is your customer's unconscious mind? It's like a vast, dark, underground sea in which a multitude of exotic creatures swim about, single and in schools, silently seeking out food, each with entirely different needs and tastes. Those creatures are your customer's expectations. And the sea in which they swim is a truly foreign place to your customer. He has no idea what's swimming around down there, what's lurking behind some subterranean rock, what's lying still and quiet as a stone on the bottom, waiting patiently and deliberately for some sweet morsel to wander by. But you can rest assured that every creature in that sea, every one of those expectations, is a product of your customer's life, of his reactions, perceptions, attitudes, associations, beliefs, opinions, inferences, conclusions, an accumulation of all of his experiences since the instant of his birth, and for all we know, before it, to this very moment when he stands before you. And all his expectations are nothing more or less than the means through which the sum of them all, your customer's personality, gets fed what it needs. The food it needs comes in the form of sensory input from the conscious mind, the surface. And if the food is compatible with its expectations, the unconscious mind says yes. And if the food is incompatible with its expectations, the unconscious mind says no. And that decision, yes or no, is made at the instant it gets a taste. In a television commercial, we're told, the sale is made or lost in the first 3 or 4 seconds. In a print ad, tests have shown, 75% of the buying decisions are made at the headline alone. In a sales presentation, data have shown us the sale is made or lost in the first 3 minutes. And all that happens after that psychographic moment of truth, after the buying decision is made, is that the unconscious mind sends its answer up to the conscious mind, which then goes back out into the world to assemble the rational armament it needs to support its already determined emotional commitment. And that's how buying decisions are made, irrationally. If anyone cared to do it, it could probably be proven that no one yet has ever made a rational decision to buy anything. So when your customer says, "I want to think about it," don't you believe him. He's not going to think about it. He doesn't know how. He's already done all the thinking he's going to do. He either wants it or not. What your customer is really saying is one of two things. He is either emotionally incapable of saying no for fear of how you might react if he told you the truth, or you haven't provided him with the food his unconscious mind craves. Either way, little or no thought enters into the transaction. Despite what we would like to believe, the decision was made unconsciously and instantaneously. In fact, it was made long before you ever met. But your customer doesn't know it. The two pillars of a successful marketing strategy. The question then becomes, if my customer doesn't know what he wants, how can I? The answer is, you can't. Not unless you know more about him than he does about himself. Not unless you know his demographics and his psychographics. Demographics and psychographics are the two essential pillars supporting a successful marketing program. If you know who your customer is, demographics, you can then determine why he buys, psychographics. And having done so, you can then begin to construct a prototype to satisfy his unconscious needs, but scientifically rather than arbitrarily. Again, demographics is the science of marketplace reality. It tells you who buys. Psychographics is the science of perceived marketplace reality. It tells you why certain demographic types buy for one reason, while other demographic types buy for another. Let me give you an example of how these sciences might be utilized in your marketing strategy. Notice the shade of blue in the jacket of this book. I call it IBM blue. Why? Because it's IBM's color. That's why, I imagine, IBM is called Big Blue in the marketplace. Why that specific shade of blue rather than another? Why blue at all? Because that shade of blue has an extraordinarily high appeal and preference to IBM's central demographic model. They see that shade of blue, and it's love at first sight. Ever heard the expression, true blue? That's what that particular color is. The color IBM's central demographic model consumer knows it can depend on. What do you think would have happened had IBM chosen orange instead of blue? Well, since orange is at the opposite end of the preferential spectrum for IBM's consumer, the IBM success story may not have been so momentous. It's hard to imagine big orange instead of big blue. I think IBM's customer would have had trouble buying an orange computer. Now, I know that sounds ridiculous, but you can test it if you like. Remember the little test I suggested earlier in this book, the one with the navy blue suit? I'd like you to visualize someone wearing such a suit. Can you see him in your mind's eye? Deep navy blue, vents in the back, possibly a pinstripe, sharply creased trousers, white starched shirt, a red and blue striped tie, black, highly polished wingtip shoes. Now, how do you feel about him? Does he look businesslike? Does he look like someone you can trust? Does he appear to represent something solid, reliable, dependable? Of course he does. Research shows that the navy suit is perhaps the most powerful suit a person can wear in business. Instant impact. Now visualize the very same person you did before, but this time he's not wearing a navy blue suit. Now he's wearing an orange suit. That's right, a two-piece orange suit. An expensive one at that. And with it, he's wearing a white-on-white silk shirt and a green-and-white striped Italian silk tie. and a silver belt buckle with his initials in green jade across its face, and a diamond tie pin, 2 carats, glimmering out at you just above the top button of his vest, and proudly peeking out of his finely creased orange pants, an incomparable pair of white lizard cowboy boots. Can you see it? Do you get the picture? Well, you better take it fast, because he's out of business. And what's important to know is that the difference between the two men isn't in them. It's in your mind, your unconscious mind. What's more, the difference is perceived instantly without a moment of thought. The fact that you couldn't conduct serious business with the man in the orange suit, but you could if he were wearing blue, says that there is no such thing as reality, at least as we understand it. Reality only exists in someone's perceptions, attitudes, beliefs, and conclusions. Whatever you wish to call those positions of the mind from which all expectations arise and nowhere else. So the famous dictum that says, find a need and fill it, is inaccurate. It should say, find a perceived need and fill it. Because if your customer doesn't perceive he needs something, he doesn't, even if he actually does. Get it? Those perceptions are at the heart of your customer's decision-making process. And if you know his demographics, you can understand what those perceptions are, and then figure out what you must do to satisfy them and the expectations they produce. You can know your customer's psychographic reality. Each demographic model has a specific set of perceptions that are identifiable in advance. Women of a certain age, with a certain amount of education, with a certain size family, living in a certain geography, buy for very specific psychographic reasons. Those unconsciously held reasons will be different from another group of women of a different age and marital status with a different educational background living in a different part of the country. And these differences predetermine what each group buys. Are you beginning to get a sense of the complexity of this business called marketing? I hope so. Because until you do, until you begin to take it seriously, until you give it the earnest attention it demands, your prototype will continue to be the only thing it could be under these circumstances, a crapshoot. At eMyth Worldwide, we've created tools for our small business clients to begin the often arduous task of making demographic and psychographic determinations and how to position their prototype in the mind of their customer. The impact has been astonishing. Small businesses that acted like small businesses when we met them began to operate with intelligence. Their customers came vividly alive to them, often for the very first time. Inquiry, the active solicitation of specific information, and controlled experimentation replaced the guessing, blind hope, and feverish busy work that preceded them. Innovation, quantification, and orchestration became the driving forces behind their efforts. The fact is, any small business can do it, and every small business must. If mature businesses, such as IBM, McDonald's, Federal Express, and Disney, take such things seriously, then how can you not do the same? Your business is far more fragile than a big business. So if anything, you must take marketing more seriously than a big business does. And time is running out. We have entered the unforgiving age. an age in which countless small businesses will either accept the challenge of an information-glutted society or be destroyed by it. An age in which your customer is deluged by so many products and promises that he becomes swamped in confusion and indecision. The challenge of our age is to learn our customer's language, and then to speak that language clearly and well, so that your voice can be heard above the din. Because if your customer doesn't hear you, he'll pass you by. No doubt you feel frustrated as you listen to this. You must be asking yourself, how do I do it? How do I determine my customer's demographics, his psychographics, what colors to use, what shapes, what words? But if you're asking these questions, you're well on your way. For the purpose of this book is not to answer these questions, but to raise them. Not how to do it, but what needs to be done. Unless you understand what needs to be done, unless you understand the essential importance of marketing to your prototype, unless you understand that your customer is far less rational in his convictions and expectations than you had ever imagined, unless you understand that your prototype is your product, all the how to do it in the world won't make a bit of difference to you. But we're not finished yet. We have one more step to take in your business development program. Your systems strategy, the glue that holds your prototype together. I know you don't want to talk about how to do it, Sarah said, squinting her eyes for mock emphasis. But if you want to leave this table alive, you're going to have to give me more than that. How do I determine the demographics and psychographics of my most important customer, she implored me. Well, I began, let's start where you are. What we already know about your business is that it's attracting someone to it, that the picture you have in your mind about the all-about pies you wish to create isn't that foreign from the one you've created. That while you didn't clearly formulate the ideas at the beginning of your business, we now know that your inner entrepreneur was busy all the time, that the caring you wish to express in the all-about pies of the future was in you all the time. It's expressed today in the delicious quality of your pies, in the beauty of your shop, and I might add, the lovely, albeit frazzled, state of your being. She snorted quietly in response as I went on. So, I believe, Sarah, it's safe for us to assume that the people coming in your door today are unconsciously expressing their preference for the caring you have so eloquently shared with me. They're buying it even now. The first question you must ask, then, is who are they? Who are my customers, specifically? What is their demographic profile? How do you answer that question? You ask them. You ask each and every one of them by having them complete a questionnaire in return for a free pie. The free pie is the price you pay for that information. The answers you get will prove to be a bonanza. But while you're at it, you might as well get the psychographic data you need as well as the geographic data you need. How do you do that? You find out on your questionnaire what colors they prefer, what shapes, what words. You find out the brands of perfume they buy, automobiles, clothes, jewelry, food. You match those brands to the ads and commercials that sell them, and you discover by becoming interested in what messages are being sent to your customers by other companies who are successfully selling to them, what messages you might send to those customers who are demographically and psychographically the same as your existing central demographic model to intentionally come in your door. How do you find them, those people you've not yet met? You buy a list of those who fit your central demographic model in what you've now determined to be your trading zone. What's your trading zone? It's the geographic perimeter within which your current customers mainly live. You take their addresses from your questionnaire, identify them on a map, draw a line around them, and that's your first pass trading zone. You then buy a list of demographically correct people living in that area. Is that enough how to do it for now? I asked Sarah with mock impatience. Will that keep you busy for a while? Because if it is, I'd like to go back to the what to do for a moment, because there's a lot more to it than meets the eye. This marketing thing isn't nearly as complicated as I might have made it seem, I continued. But it's important that you take it seriously, because it most often is regarded by small business owners as merely good common sense. And I've seen more often than not that the only definition of good common sense is my opinion. That most small business owners, suffering as they do from what I've gotten to call willful disinformation, simply decide what they want to do without any information at all, without any interest in what's true, and then simply do it. Stationery designed by the local quick printer with a logo thrown in. Colors picked by their wives. Signs designed by the local sign guy whose experience is in painting signs, not in determining what colors and shapes are psychographically correct. In short, Sarah, while you don't have to go over the scientific deep end, you do have to be sensitive to the science of the art of marketing. You have to be interested in it. In fact, you have to be interested in everything your business needs. You have to become a student of the art of business as well as the science of business. And that's the what to do part of all this. Do you realize how much marketing money is spent by companies like McDonald's, Federal Express, Disney, and Walmart to get it just right? Do you realize how much time and attention companies like PepsiCo and American Express spend to get their brands just right? And how easy it is to miss the mark? And what it costs them if they do? In a small business, you simply can't afford to spend the money they do. But you can afford to spend the time, the thought, the attention on the same questions they ask. And that's why I keep on going back to the true work of the small business owner, the strategic work rather than the tactical work. Because if you're doing tactical work all the time, if you're working all the time, devoting all your energy in your business, you won't have any time or energy left to ask, let alone answer, all of the absolutely critical questions you need to ask. You'll simply have no time or energy left to work on it. The owner of the business must start out by asking marketing questions. The COO must continue to ask marketing questions. The VP of marketing is absolutely accountable for asking marketing questions. In fact, there isn't a function or a position within the company that is free of asking marketing questions if by marketing we mean what must our business be in the mind of our customers in order for them to choose us over everyone else. And so, seen from the appropriate perspective, the entire business process by which your business does what it does is a marketing process. It starts with a promise you make to attract them to your door. It continues with the sale you make once they get there. And it ends with the delivery of the promise before they leave your door. In some companies, that process is called lead generation, lead conversion, client fulfillment. In your business, Sarah, it's called marketing, sales, and operations. But whatever you call it, It is the essential, key process that runs through every business. And it is how well integrated that process is, how totally and completely connected each part of the process appears in relation to the rest of the process, that will determine how successful you are at getting them to come back for more. And it is getting them to come back for more that is the primary aim of every business. Because what McDonald's knows, and what Federal Express knows, and what Disney knows, indeed what every extraordinary business knows, is that the customer you've got is one hell of a lot less expensive to sell to than the customer you don't have yet. And that's why the business process of lead generation, lead conversion, and client fulfillment is so critical to the growth of your business. And that's what marketing is, the whole process. Not just a part of it, but the entire thing. And it never stops. And so, while the VP Marketing and the VP Operations and the VP Finance each have their own specific accountabilities, they share one common purpose: to make a promise their customer wants to hear, and to deliver on that promise better than anyone else on the block. And the place where they join each other is at the position of COO. The COO is the driver of all this. The COO connects each part of the business process. The COO maintains the integrity of the whole by acting as the arbiter of the strategic objective he is accountable for fulfilling, of the rules of the game he is accountable for maintaining, of the game the business has chosen to play. And it is there, at that point in the middle, where hierarchy and process meet. It is there, at that point in the middle, that your business comes together. It is there, at that point, where your management system and your business development process play out their respective roles so vividly. It is at that point, the point I have called the PowerPoint in an earlier book, that a business truly becomes alive, where the static and dynamic nature of every great business meets. This is how we do it here. And then, this is how we do it here. And then, this is how we do it here. Over and over and still over again. Continuous improvement. Electrifying. Ecstatic. Alive. To do what? To deliver the promise no one else in your industry dares to make. That's what marketing is, Sarah. That's what your business must be. Alive, growing, committed to keeping a promise no competitor would dare to make. That's what needs to be done. Are you ready to do it? Just watch me, Sarah said. Then let's go on to the last part and tie it all together, I said. Let's take a look at systems and the absolutely essential role they play. Chapter 18, Your Systems Strategy. The world thus appears as a complicated tissue of events in which connections of different kinds alternate or overlap or combine and thereby determine the texture of the whole. Werner Heisenberg, Physics and Philosophy. Throughout this book, I have talked about systems without really defining what a system is. So let me do that here. A system is a set of things, actions, ideas, and information that interact with each other, and in so doing, alter other systems. In short, everything is a system. The universe, the world, San Francisco Bay, the office I'm sitting in, the computer I'm using, the cup of coffee I'm drinking, the relationship you and I are having. They're all systems. Some systems we can understand, and some we can't. Let's take a look at the ones we can. the systems in your business. Three kinds of systems. There are three kinds of systems in your business. Hard systems, soft systems, and information systems. Hard systems are in